You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 17th of January 2019 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Paul Osborne. Coming up, it's taken 4 months of tortuous negotiations, but finally Sweden has a new government. The only problem is it's not clear how long this coalition can work. Political unity is thin on the ground, too, in the US. We'll get the latest from a former White House insider as the shutdown heads towards a fifth week. Later, an update from Bogota, hit by a bomb attack that's killed at least 9 people. And we'll find out how one hotel firm is fighting back against online rivals. Plus, why is Germany worried about Chinese imports? And we'll catch up with the top stories across Asia. All in the next hour on the Monocle Daily, live from London on Monocle 24. So hello, welcome to today's Monocle Daily. So 4 months after its election, Sweden is finally getting a new government. This after long, difficult negotiations, which many times seem destined to fail. So there is a new coalition. It has been agreed, though it is distinctly precarious. Well, let's learn more now from Klas Adamson. He is the London correspondent of Swedish Broadcasting and is with me in the studio. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. Oh, we have returned to this story many times in the last 4 months as this series of talks started and failed and started and failed. After all that, though, not only do we have a coalition, we're keeping the same prime minister.
It is a bit of a surprise that he's staying in power. They will have the vote tomorrow morning, so but he will most likely win that vote, and we'll have a new government on Monday, and he will govern the Social Democrats and the Green Party together. And it is a big surprise that he gets the support from the Centre Party and the Liberals. We all thought that we would have the right-wing alliance in power in the coming years. But now the Centre Party and the Liberals, two of the parties in the right-wing alliance, has decided to switch side because they want to keep the Sweden Democrats, the Nationalist Party, outside of any influence. And they would have had influence if the right-wing alliance would have been in power.
That's been the whole thing, hasn't it, all the way through this election. The Sweden Democrats got, I think, 17, 18% of the votes.
Yeah.
But all the other parties were absolutely determined to keep them out of government. But it was then very difficult to find a way of forming a government that was viable.
Yeah, definitely. And the way they're doing it now is that we will have a government with the Social Democrats and the Green Party with 32% of the seats only in the parliament, a minority government. And then they will have the support in the budget process of the Centre Party and the Liberals. And let's see how that will work out, because the Centre Party and the Liberals, they are in some ways very right-wing parties. They have a lot of really right-wing policies when it comes to business and other stuff. And that would be very difficult for the Social Democrats to accept.
And then there's also the question of the Left Party, which is not joining this coalition, but if it were to turn against it in Parliament, the maths would suddenly become impossible.
Yeah, and, you know, in this agreement between the Centre Party and the Liberals and the government, in the document they say that they can't give the Left Party any influence over the politics, over the policies of the government. If that happens, the Centre Party and the Liberals will not accept the government anymore. So for many voters on the right side, the Left Party is as bad as the Sweden Democrats. They want to keep those two radical parties outside of any influence. So what many people on the right side think now is that the Liberals and the Centre Party are traitors because they don't believe that the Left Party will not have any influence.
And so this coalition has to keep partners happy from the centre and right of politics, has to make sure that it doesn't offend parties on the extreme left enough that they actually vote down the government. It doesn't sound like the kind of thing that's very stable or going to be able to achieve very much.
It isn't at all. And I mean, in this document, they have the agreement, they have 73 political issues. And some of them are really, really right-wing issues. Like, for example, they will have lower taxes for people with higher incomes. The government has to accept that they will make it easier for business to dismiss staff. They will have language tests for foreigners that wants to become Swedish citizens. Very right-wing policies that this government have to accept. And I think that the left party will have big difficulties to accept this in the long run. Maybe in the first budget process, but after 1 or 2 years, they can't be passive anymore. I don't think so after a couple of years.
Indeed, the left party leader said that he would fight any measure that pushes Sweden to the right. And this coalition, you would assume, is going to include measures like that.
Yeah, some say that Stefan Löfven will be prime minister in name only, that he will actually be the prime minister, but he will pursue right-wing policies. So it is a strange situation we have. And the only reason why we have it is to keep the Sweden Democrats outside of any influence. Because the normal way, if we just look at the policies of all the parties in the parliament at the moment, would be to have a right-wing government, because we have a right-wing-leaning parliament.
There's a risk, isn't there, though, that in this effort, and Lord knows it's been an effort, to keep the Sweden Democrats out of government, you allow them to develop a sort of victim status and to say not only to the people who voted for them, but to the people who maybe 4 months ago thought about voting for them and didn't, that they have been treated unfairly, that the voices of nearly one-fifth of Swedes, whatever the rest of the political establishment may think of that party, the voices of one-fifth of Swedes have been excluded from government.
And, you know, it was so close to become a failure, all this process, and we all thought for a while that we have to have snap elections. And imagine what could have happened in the snap elections. More people would probably have voted for the Sweden Democrats, probably. And I think the Liberals and the Centre Party would lose if we would have elections now. It will be very interesting to see the next poll that is coming up here in a couple of weeks to see if it has changed. But I think more people are supporting the Sweden Democrats now than they did before the last election in September.
Well, indeed, one poll suggests that only 11% of voters in Sweden think that the coalition deal is very good. It was one of the options they were given. The majority said it was in some way poor. And while it's taken 4 months to get to this stage, given all of the problems that you've talked about, all of the issues that they're going to have to work through, I mean, is this government actually going to last as long as it took to negotiate it?
Yeah, but I think you have to understand that a big majority of the population really, really dislike the Sweden Democrats. So a big majority of the population is actually quite satisfied in a way that we're keeping them outside from any influence. So I think that's the only argument we have to say that this government will actually last for a while. But still, I can't see Stefan Löfven with the type of person he is. He really wants to be in power. I can't see him just be a prime minister in name only. I think they will have really, really difficult discussions between every budget, and we have two budgets per year in Sweden. So I think they will have so much problem with agreeing over anything.
And what does it say about not just what's going on in Sweden, but the political turmoil across Europe, that a country like Sweden, who has a reputation for stable government and socially progressive government, and is thrown into this kind of political crisis with this kind of level of influence, not political influence in government, but this level of support for a party of the hard right.
Yeah. Yeah, many people think that we have too many parties in Sweden. That could be a problem. We have 8 parties in the parliament. It's very difficult.
And proportional representation system that means that no one's ever really going to win outright.
You know, the Green Party, they have 4% or something, and the Liberals, they have, 5-6? But I think a big difference, if you look at the Sweden Democrats, if you compare them to nationalist parties in the other Nordic countries, is that they have a racist background. And that's a problem, because it doesn't matter how much the party change, the other parties in the parliament will never accept them anyway because of that racist background, because they believe that it's still there in the core of the party. And that's a big difference, because if you look at Norway and Denmark, for example, the nationalist parties, they have a lot of influence in the government because they accept them, because they don't have this dark background.
It's absolutely fascinating. The last few months fascinating. Clearly, the next few months are going to be pretty fascinating too. Claes Hansen, thank you very much for joining us this evening. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, this is the 27th day of the longest government shutdown in US history, and there seems little likelihood that it's going to end anytime soon. Around 800,000 federal workers have been left without pay, even though more than half of them are still working. The Democrats want Donald Trump to delay his State of the Union address. He, in turn, has acted in the last few hours to stop his main rival from taking a foreign trip. Well, one person who has some experience of Washington, D.C. is Dr. Pippa Malmgren, who's a former economic advisor to George W. Bush when he was in the White House. She is now with me in the studio. Thank you very much for coming in.
Absolutely.
I assume you're relatively relieved to not be in the White House at the moment.
I think it would be a very tricky environment to manage, yes.
we can talk about this in the abstract, sort of the political arguments about the shutdown, but there's no, it's 800,000 federal workers unpaid, most of them actually working and just not being paid, the knock-on effect on all the other contractors who rely on business with the federal government, and the White House itself having to admit that this has had a far bigger economic impact than they were claiming a couple of weeks ago.
No, absolutely, but here's the fundamental problem, is the president feels that he was elected on the mandate to make the U.S. government smaller. And so he's been waging war with Washington from the inside. And this business of shutting the government down is making government smaller by definition. So his pain threshold on this is almost unlimited, whereas everyone else feels the pain of this situation. So this puts the negotiation more in his favor because he just doesn't care. His view is if those 800,000 people go and leave and go get a job in the private sector, excellent. And one has to understand that that is his position. Even if you totally disagree with it, that's where he is coming from.
Even if half of these people that he has not put out of work but has taken their money off them, potentially were Trump voters.
Absolutely. And I think this is the key thing, is that he doesn't care about that. And I think his popularity is now going to fall below the levels we've seen in the past, which although his popularity ratings have been low, they've been higher than most international audiences would ever have imagined, given what he's about. I think now, for the first time, we are going to see his popularity fall, even with his core supporters. Now, some of his core supporters are going to love what he's doing. But I think, broadly speaking, this undermines his reelection prospects. And I think this may be an early indicator that he isn't going to run again.
You think that because there is a Trump 2020 campaign, there are people who are working on it.
No, I know. And I absolutely understand that. But I have a suspicion that what may happen is that he has always wanted to launch what they call TNN. That's a kind of Trump news station that rivals CNN. And remember, that's the only reason he ran for the presidency in the first place, was to raise the money to launch TNN. And he genuinely believes that's a bigger, more influential platform than the Oval Office. And to be fair, that may not be wrong, and a wrong assessment. So is he creating the conditions where he could launch TNN and have a bigger voice and more influence than he does as president? It's quite possible. And this kind of dramatic behavior now sets the stage for that, potentially.
What about this latest thing that he's done today? That Nancy Pelosi said, look, you should cancel the State of the Union, which I think is due in about 12 days' time. And his response to this is to wait until she's pretty much on the tarmac, about to take off to head to Brussels and then off to Afghanistan, and says, you can't use a government plane, I'm cancelling your trip. Yes. Now, that looks, to the casual observer, a little bit petty and unpresidential.
But are people really surprised? He's been petty and unpresidential since he arrived, in a sense. I mean, he's picked every issue and hit the furthest below the belt that you can. So I don't see any inconsistency. What is interesting is people remain surprised. Look, this is a person who made their living in property deals. In property deals, you promise anything, you renege on any promise with the slightest of reason. I mean, he comes from a space where you pull the rug out from your opposition at every possible opportunity. He's just bringing these same tactics into government.
I was going to say, inevitably, at some stage, someone has to blink in order
yes.
to start the process of negotiating that can end the shutdown. But from what you're saying, it sounds like we're about to move into the fifth week of this government shutdown. He might not mind if we're talking about it moving into a fifth month.
I think that is what I'm saying. And I, having worked in politics much of my life and around it, and my dad served four presidents, so I've really grown up around this. I think that we have to understand his pain threshold is very different from any other politician we've seen in modern history. And he is willing to bear that pain because for him, it's almost costless. It works in his favor for the audience that he really depends upon. And if he isn't going to run again, if he actually is going to step onto what he perceives to be a bigger, better, more dramatic platform, then we should stop underestimating his ability to hold his breath here.
Let's look at how you could theoretically try to end this, assuming that the will existed to do that. This all started with this argument where he wanted $5.5 billion for the wall. Democrats weren't going to give it to him. Now, in the past, Democrats will say, well, look, you've asked for money before in return for things like the Dreamers rows about the kids on the DACA program.
Yeah.
And then you took the deal away at the last minute. So actually, us just saying you can have the money for the wall, there's no guarantee that you'll end the shutdown then. So what do you do? What's the first step to trying to get the government open again?
This is an excellent question. And really, the question is, what is his point of vulnerability? And again, if he isn't running again, he doesn't have many points of vulnerability. And I think this is the whole point, is we're assuming that a person who is president is part of the political process and wants to be. But this is a guy who came to power saying, I want to wage war on the government from the inside, cause it to be much smaller, if not go away entirely, you know, shut down whole agencies of government. What better way than to just shut the whole thing down? And so this is what makes this negotiation so very, very difficult, is what you have really are both Republicans and Democrats playing by traditional rules, because that's what the book says. This is the traditional way. And we have a president who is not even caring what is in the rule book.
Is one possible route to getting him to change tack that even the people who, like Donald Trump, would admit he has this pathological need to be acclaimed, to be liked.
Mm.
If even the people who so far have gone with him are turning against him and saying, you're hurting the country, would that not have an impact?
You know, absolutely. Look, politicians, generally speaking, can always appeal to the ego, but this is amplified in this particular case. But what is the capacity of both Republicans and Democrat leaders to do this? Not very high. And really what we're talking about is a total transformation of the power structure in Washington. Because let's face it, the Republicans also have a problem because some of the things that Trump is doing are things that they had promised to do and never completed themselves. So it's very hard for them to object to some of his strategies and policies. For the Democrats, there are some governors of states who are in agreement with the business of shrinking the size of government and pushing the powers back to the state level. So it's what it's doing is it's ending the period of history where we had a clear left and a clear right, and suddenly forcing everybody to rethink, where do I actually stand on individual issues, not just which party am I backing? And that is partly what I think has brought to power a new generation of politicians, particularly in the Congress, who are extraordinarily different from anything we've ever seen before. Many more women, vast majority of them are people who come from an apolitical, non-political background. These are outsiders. So weirdly, America is on a pathway of electing outsiders to politics. Trump was one, but they're continuing on that path. And maybe the solution lies in that place.
Just lastly, I say you work for George W. Bush in the White House. If you can bear the thought of being in there now, working for Donald Trump, if you had his ear, what would you say to him?
Well, you know, first of all, I think that's part of the problem is nobody does have his ear. This is a person who's making their own decisions on whatever basis, and it's not necessarily on the basis of the memos that you're writing for him. And I think that's why a lot of the people around him are leaving. So that's the first assumption, is that even if you were sitting there, that you would have his ear. So I don't think you would. You might have to do reverse psychology, basically, and say, okay, if you want to shut the government down, what are other ways we could do this more effectively?
Do you think he'd listen?
He's not known for his listening skills, I must say.
Admittedly, listening does not appear to be one of his attributes. Dr. Pippa Mangum, thank you very much for coming in this evening. Still to come on the Monocle Daily, we'll get the latest from Bogota in just a moment after a bomb attack blamed by the government there on a terror group.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Mention the name Funkhaus in Berlin and you'll be greeted with excited curiosity or a mysterious smile from those in the know. The former communist broadcasting house got a new lease of life when young musicians hunkered down. Monocle Films set out on a tour of the stunning studios and recording halls. Funkhaus, on the same wavelength, playing now in the film section at monocle.com.
To Colombia next, where the government is calling a car bomb at a police academy in Bogota an act of terrorism. At least 9 people died and dozens more were injured in the biggest attack on a police or military facility in the city in more than a decade. We can cross now to Monocle's correspondent in Bogota, Anastasia Maloney. First of all, can you give us the latest on the attack and the investigation into it?
Yes, yeah, so far the government is saying that the death toll has risen to 10 people who have been killed in the attack that took place at about 9:30 a.m. local Bogota time. Dozens more have been injured, and the government has now released the name of the driver of the car during the attack. Witnesses say that the driver rammed the car into the entrance of a police academy in South Bogota. The government has said that there are criminal structures behind the attack, but hasn't said who they think is behind it, and no group or armed group or criminal gang has yet claimed responsibility for the attack.
So no one's claimed it, but there must be some thoughts as to who's likely to have been behind it.
Yeah, there's plenty of speculation about who could be responsible for it, and there's various armed groups and criminal gangs operating in Colombia that could be responsible. Much of the attention at the moment is focused on Colombia's small guerrilla group, the ELN, the National Liberation Army. If they did carry out the attack, it's very poignant that they would have chosen a police academy where young cadets were training. It's a poignant symbol. It's sending a message to the government that its police and military forces aren't safe. And it's definitely, the place of the attack was definitely chosen precisely because it is a military facility. So one theory is that the ELN could be behind it. Then you have other groups linked to drug cartels. They could also be involved. And finally, you have people from the other guerrilla group, the FARC guerrilla group, the so-called FARC dissidents that didn't join the peace process and didn't demobilize, who are upset with the peace deal, and they could also be behind this attack. So there's various groups that could be involved, and as I said earlier, the government hasn't yet said who they think is behind this attack.
The concern, presumably, is whether this is an isolated flare-up of some sort or a sign of something more serious coming down the track.
Yes, it's also a real, it's also come as a real shock to people living in Bogota and Colombia as a whole, because, you know, the idea, the feeling was that these kinds of attacks and explosions and car bombs, which were really common in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, this was a thing of the past. Bogotanos have got used to living in relative peace. The murder rates have gone down, crime's gone down. Bogota's a much safer place than it was a decade ago. And these kind of attacks haven't happened for a while. And so it's a real shock for people to think that, is this a sign of, you know, a pattern of things to come, or as you say, is this an isolated incident? It's not clear, but the government has said that it has opened the investigation and that it will hold those responsible for the attacks.
And have we heard anything from those who transitioned in the peace process from the FARC, from the guerrilla movement, to politics?
Yes, the FARC is now a political party. Their top commanders have demobilized, and some of them hold seats in Congress and the Senate. And they have issued a statement saying that they condemned the attack and that they were working to promote peace in Colombia. So that suggests that, you know, they are against this attack, and people are saying if they are to believe, then they're not part of it. However, as I said earlier, there are dissident groups of the FARC that didn't demobilise, and so people are saying, well, perhaps it's members of those groups.
Anastasia Maloney in Bogota, thank you very much. In just a moment, we'll find out how one hotel firm's fighting back against online rivals. But first, let's catch up with some of the day's other top news stories. France's Prime Minister is warning a no-deal Brexit is increasingly likely. Edouard Philippe says the country has activated a contingency plan, which involves spending millions preparing French ports. In London, there have been further cross-party talks to try to agree a way forward on Brexit, but the leader of the opposition Labour Party is still refusing to take part. It's claimed the US government may have separated thousands more immigrant children from their parents than previously known. An internal government watchdog says poor record-keeping means it's still not clear exactly how many children were split from their families. The report says that more than 100, including dozens under the age of 5, were separated after Donald Trump halted the policy. Vladimir Putin has been given a puppy by the president of Serbia at the start of an official visit to the country. The Russian leader's trying to cement ties with Serbia, which is hoping to join the European Union. Putin has accused the US and other Western countries of trying to destabilize the region. This is the Monocle Daily. Vladimir Putin doesn't strike me as necessarily the best guardian of a puppy, still I'm sure the gift was well-intentioned. Now, the hospitality industry has had a lot to cope with lately, not least the threat of online rivals like Airbnb. But by offering more personal experiences, hotels have been fighting back. One example is Design Hotels, which after 25 years under the stewardship of its founder, Klaus Senninger, now has a new CEO who has some big plans of his own. That new boss is Peter Cole, who earlier spoke to Monocle's Josh Fennett.
Design Hotels is a portfolio of hotels that are independently owned and operated that have a well-developed concept of people, culture, design, architecture that aspire to put their hotel out onto the market. Design Hotels as a company is a sales and marketing and distribution business. We've created a community of travelers organized around design, architecture, culture, and organize these hotels in a way that enables the customer to come and experience what we call original hospitality experiences.
And I suppose for the past 25 years, that company has become synonymous with its founder, with Klaus Sendlinger, with a kind of freewheeling, experimental, interesting, experience-based notion behind it. At the end of last year, you joined Klaus, took over the role as the CEO. I imagine his thumbprint will still be on some of the work moving forward. But can you tell me what it's like to join a company with a vast amount of experience from Marriott, obviously, in your case, and to try and adjust to that company's DNA? Was it a bit of a shock at first, or did you hit the ground running?
Yeah, it's been actually quite an interesting journey. Klaus, as you mentioned, has created this company over the last 25 years, which has really become the definitive source for original hospitality and organizing what we call the originals, what Design Hotels originals, with the owners. Klaus has really created this tightly knit group of people who are very passionate about their own hotel and about the brand that is Design Hotels. So for me, over the last 6 months, I've had a real luxury of being able to partner with Klaus as we do this extended handover. And luckily for us, he's agreed to stay involved as our brand consultant, as our advisor. And he's built up a great team. And so I have a phenomenal ability to work with a team that he's built over the last 10 years. And we're very, very organized and committed to maintaining the health and the brand that is Design Hotels. For me, it's just a fantastic experience of being able to join this great, strong, well-known brand and then be able to try to work on how we can take it forward.
And Peter, you don't simply bring to this role an admiration of Klaus's work and a knowledge of what Design Hotels might be in the future. You bring with you a wealth of experience from Marriott. You know, you're used to operating in scale. You're used to operating probably with a few more zeros, if we're being perfectly honest, and a higher capacity of rooms and stuff. Tell me, what is the challenge of coming into a smaller company like this? And what do you think are the opportunities from having been in that kind of world?
So one of the things that I like to think about that I can bring to Design Hotels is, over the course of my career with Marriott, I have spent a lot of time working on trying to develop partnerships. Marriott doesn't own the hotels. They partner with owners of hotels and they franchise. And yes, it is an extremely large scale. But the only way that they can be successful is by developing strong partnerships. Most of those hotels are owned by financial owners or institutions. And you still need to develop a good relationship. So where I think I can now have an even greater impact and a lot of fun is by working with individual owners and developing that partnership. We work with the hotels. Their individual brand curates up to help support our brand, but at the end of the day, we're distributing their hotel. We're their help, we're their partner in terms of trying to put business into the hotel. We leverage the partnership with Marriott, where Marriott has its loyalty program, and that's a channel that we take advantage of in order to put customers into our owners' hotels. And that's where I think I can bring that partnership point of view to help make them successful, which in turn makes Design Hotels successful.
And what do you think are going to be the important topics for the hospitality industry and for yourself helming Design Hotels over the next kind of 12 months? What can people expect to see as you get into full swing with this role? What can we expect for Design Hotels for the next year to 5 years?
So what we described to our member hotels back last fall is still something that we're going to pursue this year. Those are organized around making sure, number one, that the brand continues to thrive. So in 2019, you will see engagements with artistic, cultural, design-oriented individuals that Design Hotels can sponsor to show that the brand is still resonating really well with that community. We are going to be working on things that we can provide to our member hotels, so such that we try to engender their loyalty, how we continue to pull those hotels in. We were at over 30 hotels last year and ended the year over 300 hotels in our portfolio. So we will continue to add hotels as we can continue to curate our portfolio. And then finally, we're going to continue to follow the community. And where do they want to spend their time? Where do they want to engage with architecture, design, and culture? And where can we then follow them or lead them? And continuing to really make sure that the Design Hotels brand meets the needs of its originals and of its community.
And that is the new CEO of Design Hotels, Peter Cole, speaking there to Monocle's Josh Fennett. Now, it's not been a great few months for the Chinese economy, what with the trade war with the US and the rows over Huawei, and we'll talk a little more about that later on in tonight's programme. But it's not all bad news. China is an increasingly ambitious exporter to countries that used to see the trade going in the opposite direction. That is creating all kinds of problems for countries like Germany. To explain more, I'm joined now by Sarah Fowler, who's an international economy analyst at Oxford Analytica. Sarah, Germany in the past has done very well selling to China, but now the trade is starting to flow the other way.
That's right, yes. And there's two reasons for this. China has been moving into higher value segments, so it's making more itself of what it used to buy from countries such as Germany. And then the Chinese economy is also slowing, so it's buying less generally from the rest of the world. So there's two going on there.
Of course, there are economic problems in Germany. The rate of growth in the German economy, according to the most recent forecast, is slowing quite sharply. So anything that suggests that the export market is going to shrink for them is another problem they don't need.
That's right, yes. And they have problems because they're behind the US and China in a number of new technologies, areas such as artificial intelligence and blockchain. In the last 5 years, more than half of the investment into artificial intelligence across the world was in China. So Germany is playing catch up in some areas like that, that it needs to improve its competitiveness in to raise its exports in those areas.
There's a sense from some people that you speak to that China is just a bit more nimble, a bit more innovative, a bit faster moving than some older established economies and manufacturers like the ones you see in Germany.
Yes, well, the European Union investment in innovation has to be split between the 27 countries. So there's been no large single state with the fundamental drive for the research. So all the top tech companies, the so-called FANGs, are all US. There's no European FANG. So they're definitely playing catch up, but there are ways that they can catch up faster. The German government is planning to invest 3 billion euros in artificial intelligence in the next 5 years or so. So they are definitely setting policies much more to do this now.
How confident would Germany be of being able to keep pace with China, though?
I think in certain services sectors, it still has a big advantage. It's much, much more established. It runs a huge surplus. And with the US administration currently being anti-climate change and these kind of things, climate change is an area where actually Germany and China have been quite good allies over the last couple of years. So there are quite a few areas where they are cooperating well on. If they do deals like they're talking about at the moment, letting each other have more access to each other's financial sector, there are a lot of services sectors that they can get mutual benefits out of working together in.
Sarah, thank you very much. Sarah Fowler is from Oxford Analytica. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Now, one of North Korea's top negotiators is heading for Washington. Kim Jong-chol is reportedly carrying a letter from the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un, for Donald Trump. That has added to the speculation that a second summit between the two men could be close. Well, earlier, Monocle's Tom Edwards spoke to Dr. John Nilsson Wright, who is a senior lecturer in modern Japan at Cambridge University. He started by asking if these latest talks are a cause for optimism.
The big issue that I think is focusing people's minds is the possibility that this meeting is preparation for the much anticipated second summit between President Trump and his North Korean counterpart. There's been a lot of reporting from South Korea suggesting that Kim Jong-chol will not only meet Secretary of State Pompeo on Friday, but also that he will meet President Trump at the White House. That would be a significant development. We know that the North Korean leader, in his New Year's address, had made it clear that he wanted a change of attitude on the part of the Americans. Donald Trump himself, of course, has been signaling recently that a second summit meeting is potentially on the cards. If, in fact, this visit to Washington produces such a meeting, a lot of people will be asking what will be the point of this, what will be the focus, where will it take place. So I think it's a good sign that the two countries are talking, but we'll have to wait and see before the details of that discussion come out on Friday.
And John, as ever with these sorts of discussions, I guess the views of the other key stakeholders are often as interesting as those of the two main protagonists. And in this case, that's certainly true, one imagines. Does this sort of, if there are moves afoot between Pyongyang and Washington, does that sort of come with the tacit or, you know, de facto blessing or endorsement of other stakeholders, whether that's Tokyo, whether that's Beijing, whether that's Seoul? What do you think that the main narrative will be in those markets when these sorts of headlines trickle out?
Well, the South Koreans, of course, President Moon in particular, have been particularly eager to see Washington and Pyongyang meet again. They see this as a critically important part of the process of North-South Korean rapprochement. They know that in the present climate, with the Americans concerned that the North Koreans are yet to provide real concrete evidence of progress in denuclearization, unless there's movement in that area, it's very difficult for Seoul to move closer to Pyongyang. We, of course, had that very important four-day visit by Kim Jong-un to China for his meeting with Xi Jinping, and that may well have laid the foundation for China's willingness to support such a meeting. And, of course, with Beijing and Pyongyang apparently closer together, that may enhance the confidence of the North Korean leader in believing that it is a propitious time, given, of course, all the political difficulties that President Trump is having at home, to open up the route to further negotiations. And I should point out also, there were reports that Stephen Biegun, the American special envoy for North Korea, may well meet shortly in Stockholm with the vice foreign minister of North Korea, Choi Son-hui. So there are, I think, lots of very significant indications that Washington and Pyongyang are inching ever closer to the possibility of that second important meeting.
Well, John, let me ask you a slightly sort of playful question about that prospective second meeting. Let's say that the red phone in the Nilsen Wright office in Cambridge rings and somebody says, look, John, you're in charge of setting the agenda for the meeting. What would you be chucking into that agenda document? Is there sort of just one thing? Is it just about denuclearization? Are there other issues you think that would be germane for them to talk about?
Oh, how tempting. Well, obviously, the ultimate goal for the Americans is progress on denuclearization. But I think the key issue here is, how do you define progress, right? The end point is not going to be realized overnight. And the North Koreans have, you know, themselves said they want assurances, security assurances. So there's been talk of perhaps establishing a hotline between Washington and Pyongyang to improve direct contact. The possibility of a peace declaration, some effort to signal the end of the Korean War, maybe even the establishment of a liaison mission. The Americans, of course, have balked at that possibility because they argue that there's been no real concrete progress on the Singapore summit, the first summit, where the North Koreans have made it clear that they were prepared to move on denuclearization. I think it's unrealistic to expect North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons, but moving towards some form of accommodation and some form of sequenced trade of concessions from both sides will move the process forward. And after all, we've not seen any return so far to the risk of fire and fury. It was quite worrying that in the New Year's Day address from the North Korean leader obliquely hinted at the possibility of alternative routes to protect its own national sovereignty if it sees no progress in its talks with the Americans. So there is, I think, a bit of gamesmanship going on here. I would think that the Americans need to offer something, but at the same time, they need to be clear that the North Koreans need to show something more deliberate and concrete when it comes to satisfying their expectations that the process of denuclearization will really genuinely start.
That's John Nilsen Wright from the University of Cambridge speaking earlier to Monocle's Tom Edwards. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. We'll shift our focus to Asia in just a moment.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
Are you fed up with the white noise that often passes for news coverage? If you want something more than soundbite journalism when it comes to the big issues of the day, then join Monocle's editors and guests for The View from Midori House. Informed analysis, serious debate, and lively discussion. Every weekday at 1800 London time, tune in to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Well, let's look at some of the stories in the press across Asia with my guest in the studio this evening, the editor of China Dialogue, Isabel Hilton. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. We start with this. We talk a lot about the trade war between China and the US. We were talking about a little earlier in the programme, but there's a significant growing spat with Canada too.
This one runs and runs, actually, and it goes back to this particular case of Huawei, which is, of course, China's, you know, biggest high-tech firm. It's the biggest telecom provider and so on. And after its COO, Ms. Meng, was arrested in Canada at the request of the United States, the Chinese turned on Canada with a vengeance. And since then, this row has just been growing and growing. So now we have now three Canadian citizens have been detained in China. It was the third one today, who is the daughter of a prominent dissident who had been given a visa to visit her father in jail. She's Canadian citizen. When she got to China, she was detained, told she couldn't see her father, and then not allowed entry. But today she was coming back through China in transit and was taken off the plane. So that's the third one. Then there's the fourth, Michael Schellenberg, who unfortunately was convicted on drug offences and sentenced to prison, but his case was revised and he's now under a death sentence. So that's the background. Meanwhile, Huawei is in deeper and deeper trouble everywhere. Oxford University has said it won't take any sponsorship anymore until this is cleared up. Two congressmen have introduced a bill which would ban the sale of American chips to Huawei if they were caught busting sanctions. And there's a kind of spat going on in very, very public and unpleasant terms in the Chinese media, accusing Canada rather than the United States of politicizing justice. So whenever a Canadian citizen is arrested, the Chinese are hitting back with, you know, there is no justice in Canada. This is an entirely political move. And this goes on. So, you know, they're defending the People's Daily, the Global Times, which is, of course, the, you know, particularly nationalist newspaper, has been particularly savage in terms of denigrating Canadian justice. They are really saying that the United States is out to crush Huawei, that you know there is no justice at all in what Washington and its allies are saying about Huawei, and that this is essentially digital McCarthyism, that there's a witch hunt going on in the United States against Huawei.
Do you think they've got a point? I mean, is there a line that is crossed between legitimate concerns about the activities of a company like Huawei that we know must be acting to some extent with the knowledge or approval of the Chinese state, and the extent to which it does just take on a momentum of its own, that countries around the world just start to believe, oh, yes, this is actually just a front for the Chinese government to spy on everybody?
Well, the problem is 5G, because, you know, we have had Huawei equipment. We certainly have it in Britain installed in the digital infrastructure. But after it was installed, there were certainly second thoughts. And there was an Intelligence and Security Committee report from the House of Commons on that particular deal, which was pretty blistering, and which set up a system whereby GCHQ, the British, you know, kind of spy centre, was supposed to monitor all the millions of lines of code and search the equipment for backdoor. But this was really an exercise in closing the stable door. Since then, Huawei has gone on expanding, but the arrival of 5G and China's kind of ambitions on big data and the complete lack of any, you know, kind of privacy or inhibition in terms of the way the Chinese state uses information has raised really quite serious concerns. And they don't all come from the United States, Germany, also Australia, New Zealand. They've all said essentially they're going to try and ban Huawei equipment from the 5G network. So there is really a case. And the problem is that Huawei goes on insisting, of course, that it's a private company, that it has nothing to do with espionage of the government. In fact, the founder came out and gave a press interview in China 2 days ago, which is a very rare thing, in which he said he would refuse any request from the Chinese government to spy. The problem is that under Chinese law, Huawei can't refuse. There are two key bits of law which say essentially that any company and any citizen is obliged to cooperate with the Chinese security system when it's requested to. And the case that the company is making, that it's independent, is being undermined on a daily basis by the actions of the government. Are we to suppose that the arrest of three Canadian citizens is coincidence, or is the Chinese government defending Huawei as though the government itself was under attack?
Let's move on, because it is nearly the year of the pig. That means that the papers are full of the same sort of fluffy stories you see every day in the British press, but a slightly different tone to them, I suspect.
Well, yes, you know, the fluffy stories are all about, you know, what are the characteristics of the year of the pig? If you're born in the year of the pig, you know, will you have a good year? And all that kind of thing. But the problem, unfortunately, the PR problem of the year of the pig is that, as we discover in the Chinese press today, particularly in Caixin and the South China Morning Post, there is a terrible outbreak of swine fever in China, and the number of pigs that have had to be culled as a result of this disease outbreak is approaching a million, and it's showing no signs of slowing down.
It's not the best backdrop for all of those fluffy sort of pig related stories.
Well, it's pretty dire, and it comes against a background of a huge expansion in enormous, you know, pig factories in China. They're in fact, the Brits are doing rather well out of selling pig semen. If you remember, Cameron, when he was prime minister, went to China with a massive trade delegation and came back pretty much with the only contract signed was a contract for pig semen.
Didn't make too much of a noise about that, did he?
Well, those of us who watch these things did notice, and they then set up these farms, which are, you know, produce a quarter of a million piglets a year, but without really the infrastructure in terms of, you know, control of drugs and controls of disease, the kind of biosecurity that kind of thing requires. And I'm afraid this is the result. So the year of the pig is beginning rather bad.
Just very quickly before we end, I always like to expand my vocabulary. What is fubbing?
Well, you may well ask, but I can tell you that it's illegal in Wenzhou. And it appears to be, fubbing does appear to be crossing a pedestrian crossing while looking at your mobile phone. And the first ticket for this crime was issued yesterday, as reported in the People's Daily, by a woman police person, a policewoman, who issued it to a lady who was guilty of exactly that. I think if we're doing that in London, we'd have half the population of London paying fines.
Well, fubbing sounds very close to another word you might say when someone who's looking at their phone steps out in front of you when you're driving. I mean, I know the Chinese have a track record of being, shall we say, a little bit over-enthusiastic when it comes to policing the activities of their citizens. But here is a policy we can possibly all get behind. Isabel Hilton, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much for coming in this evening. You're listening to The Daily from Monocle 24. Finally tonight to Vienna, where a 100-year-old beverage business is trying to adapt to modern times. Monocle's Alexei Kolarov is in the Austrian capital. He spoke to the design agency Büro F, who've been tasked with rebranding Rauch juices and juice bars.
Speak to anyone in the beverage industry in Austria, and one name will crop up over and over again. Rauch. To begin with, this family-run Austrian company does all the canning and filling for Red Bull, but it also produces its own range of soft drinks and juices. It also runs a handful of dedicated juice bars in Austria and Germany. But like any big company, Rauch has got to keep up with the times. And the times demand that packaging design become ever simpler, ever more appealing.
We started the redesign, I think, about 3 years ago, and it was a very long process. Because, yeah, if you're working for a bigger company, there are many people who have an opinion about things. And so it took us quite a while to get the result we wanted.
This is Philipp Stürzenbecher from the Vienna-based design agency Büro F. Together with his partner, Fabian Feltus, he's been busy giving Rauch a more modern look. The first thing they changed was the logo.
Well, the logo used to be called Rauch Juice Bar Sonne, which means Rauch Juice Bar Sun, because it is round and yellow. And we, of course, kept the round shape, but we transformed it a little to make it more crafted and more...
It's a little bit organic, you could quite say. Yeah, it's not a perfect shape, but it fits to our main topic, which is crafted, because Rauch Juice Bar is all about fresh juice.
It has just really big, funny type, big letters that says Juice Bar. And for each product that we have, like we have cold pressed juice, we have smoothies and other fresh juices, the shape of this circle or, yeah, sun changes a little bit to make it really organic and
the colors differ
vibrant. And the colors differ as well. Yeah.
How much of a departure was that from the original design? And was it hard to convince them to go with this?
It was a bit harder because they used to work with a multivitamin tree that used to be part of the logo, which was really complex and got really difficult if you used the logo in a kind of smaller scale. It was hard to lose this tree on our way, but I think nobody could imagine to go back to the old one anymore. Mm.
I think that in the first branding they did for the Rauch Juice, but they especially failed there because they took the actual Rauch logo and didn't put it into the new context, actually. And this is where we came in and said it's not fitting the project you want to make. You want to open these cool bars everywhere and you have a great concept, but you come with this old-fashioned logo and want to put it in this new story or new chapter of your company. And it was really difficult in the beginning. Yeah, after 1.5 years, we were where we wanted to be, yeah.
But what are the constraints that you have to work with? So for instance, these bottles that we have in front of us, the shapes were a given, yeah? You could not choose the shapes of the bottles.
That's true, yeah, because like you have to change the whole factory if you want to change a bottle. Actually, it's not so easy, but for example, there were some products or some bottles they already had, yeah? So we worked with them. There's two of them, yeah. But for example, the smoothie, that was a new product for them. And so there we were also involved in the process of finding the right bottle. And you know, if you could see it in front of you, this bottle is much more reduced and fits the brand much better, actually. And I think in the future, there will be some changes with the other bottles as well, I think, yeah.
And yeah, there's even more to come, but we are not allowed to tell yet.
No, but I mean, this is really amazing that this whole revamp of the company going on and you're part of it. How do you feel about that? Do you feel privileged or is it just, oh, it's another client?
No, actually, we feel really privileged because we are a small company who is working for a really big player in Austria, actually, and it's like we work together for 100 years, actually.
Also, there's a lot of trust. They trust us in our ideas and also in our design. So that makes it really fun to work with them.
Mm. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
There'll be more food and drink stories in the menu, which you can hear for the first time at 1900 London time tomorrow here on Monocle 24, anytime after that at monocle.com. But that's it for this Monocle Daily. It was produced by Daniel Bache and Tom Hall. Our researchers are Daphne Carnesis and Martha Libri, and our studio manager was Sarah Miles. Marcus Hippie will be here for The Globalist from 7 a.m. London time tomorrow, and The Daily's back at 2200 in London tomorrow evening. For now, though, from me, Paul Osborne, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.